Hi friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Just a reminder to sign up for our weekly emails that you can find on Substack at readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can find a write-up of our weekly class along with all of the links to the articles and books that I have discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Sefer Vayikra begins with the eponymous calling of Moshe to God. Vayikra el Moshe vayedaber Hashem elav me'ohel moed lemor. As many may already know, the letter Aleph in the word Vayikra is written deliberately small. And as many ask in the opening to our parsha, why in fact is the Aleph in Vayikra written so small? And as with any of these like major questions, there are like 1,000 answers to this. The Baal HaTurim explains that the Aleph is written small out of the humility of Moshe. He writes, Aleph de Vayikra Zeira is small. Shemoshe lo rata lichtov ela Vayikar. Moshe only wanted to write Vayikar, and they happened upon one another. And Rashi also alludes to this. There's no greater honor in this world than being called upon by God to speak. There's a big difference between bumping into someone on the street and someone actually reaching out to you and inquiring, when are you available to talk? When can we put some time on the calendar? The former is happenstance. The latter is deliberate. God calling upon Moshe was a sign of God's love and affection for Moshe, something that out of Moshe's humility, he was uncomfortable writing explicitly in the Torah. Instead, as the Baal HaTurim explains, the word was written with a small aleph, making the word Vayikra look like the word Vayikar, meaning chanced upon. An additional reason, of another famous one, is cited by the Klei Yakar, that the small aleph represents children who, according to the Midrash, used to begin their study of Chumash with our Parsha. And just as the sacrifices that we read about in Parsha's Vayikra bring purity, bring Tara, so too children represent that purity. To represent the connection between our Parsha and children, we have a little small childlike Aleph, a teeny tiny Aleph. These explanations are both moving and powerful, but they do not fully explain the mystery of the small Aleph. Why here and why now? To understand this, let's explore the fascinating history behind, drumroll please, because buckle up, this is going to be a wild ride, behind the concept of infinity and its connection to Jewish thought. I'll be honest with you, I was never good at math, but I've always been intrigued by numbers. I read a lot of books about the history of mathematics. Mathematical descriptions of God and Torah have always fascinated me, particularly the concept of infinity. When I was studying in Neir Yisrael, I actually had a correspondence with someone named Shmuel Weinberger, who's the professor of mathematics at the University of Chicago, a fascinating person that was all about how the system of Torah differs from math. I remember hearing Rabbeim describe the infinitude of Torah, how the Torah is infinite. And I want to understand, like, what does that even mean? Does that mean that any idea in the Torah has potentially an infinite amount of explanations? And I carried on this long correspondence with Professor Shmuel Weinberger. Hopefully one day I'll share that correspondence, but that day is not today. God is described as infinite. In Tehillim, if you look at the 147th chapter of Tehillim, Kuf Mem Zion, God's wisdom is described as being beyond measure. At some point in history, which Gershom Sholem admits, Gershom Sholem, the great scholar of mysticism, says it's really hard to point out exactly when this occurred, but references to God himself, so to speak, began to use the term of infinity. Ein Sof, meaning without end. We began to refer to God as infinite. As Sandra Vallebrug Perry writes convincingly in her article, and I have to thank somebody whose fingerprints are all over these shiurim, my dearest friend, Eli Rubin, Rabbi Eli Rubin, who works with Chabad.org. He showed me this article. It's wonderful. It's dense, and it's really hard to read academic articles in mysticism, but I did my best. The article is called The Concept of Infinity, Ein Sof, and the Rise of Theosophical Kabbalah. That is not a term that is going to win you any friends, just FYI. But she writes in this article that the notion of God as infinite finds its most clear articulation in Kabbalistic literature, particularly in Sefer Yetzirah. Infinity in this concept is not the mathematical infinity, but rather the divine unity that underlies all of reality. To be unified is synonymous with infinity, she writes, and to be separated is synonymous with being finite. Even within our finite experience, we still remain connected to the unspeakable divine. Ein Sof in this reading is not uncountability, but omniscience and accessibility, that it is that infinity that undergirds all of reality. Ein Sof opens up a bridge rather than a chasm, she writes. Even our seemingly finite existence remains tethered to transcendence. Mathematical infinity has its own fascinating history, one that intersects, as we shall see, with both Jewish thought and Jewish law. But first, a little introduction. Zeno of Ely, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but Zeno is credited with a paradox, and I think that's like 4th century, in the 300s of the Common Era. Zeno's credited with a paradox that helps explain why the notion of infinity is so troubling for mathematicians. His paradox, known as Zeno's paradox, goes as follows. Imagine you want to walk from one end of the room to the other. Before you can get there, you need to cover half the distance. Then before you cover that remaining half, you need to cover half of that distance, and so on ad infinitum, forever. Zeno argued that if you keep dividing the distance into halves, you'll never reach the end because there'll always be another half to cover, thereby making motion seemingly impossible. So that's why it's called Zeno's paradox. We know motion is possible, but how do you even move if every space that you have to traverse ultimately can be divided infinitely? You'll never move anywhere. This paradox, of course, has been resolved through mathematical understanding. In real life situations, we do reach destinations despite the infinite divisions suggested by Zeno's paradox. We understand now that the sum of an infinite series, the sum of all those half distances, can converge on a finite value, allowing motion to occur in finite space. This is how even a finite distance can contain infinity. Pythagoras attributed divine significance to numbers. You probably remember Pythagoras from his famous Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, and that theory got him into a whole lot of trouble because he saw whole numbers as the expression of God in the world. Whole numbers meaning 1, 2, 2.5, 3, 3.5. But when irrational numbers, a type of real number that cannot be expressed as a simple fraction or ratio of two integers, numbers that go on forever, once irrational numbers were discovered, it created a major controversy. Such numbers like the square root of 2, that happens all the time in Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, so you could have the slope of a line that ends up equaling the square root of 2, but it cannot be expressed as any fraction, and that number of what the square root of 2 is goes on ad infinitum, for infinity, forever. Those kind of numbers were seen as ungodly, and they were meant to be kept a secret that they even existed. Allegedly, when Hippasus, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that name correctly either, but he was a member of the Pythagorean society, when he divulged the existence of these irrational numbers, these numbers that go on forever, can't be expressed as a fraction or as a whole integer, he was actually drowned at sea as a punishment. That's a legend that is told. Undoubtedly, the most famous irrational number is pi, a special number in mathematics that is used to describe the relationship between a circle's circumference and its diameter. For those who haven't been involved in high school math for some time, I don't blame you for being a little anxious right now and for turning off this year a little bit early. I don't blame you if all your math anxiety is coming to the fore now, but stay with me. Pi is the ratio between the circumference of a circle, that's the distance all the way around the circle, and its diameter, that line that goes straight through the center of the circle, touching two points on the edge. Now, no matter how big or small the circle is, if you divide the circumference by the diameter, you'll always get the same number, approximately 3.14159, that goes on infinitely without repeating. That number is called pi, and we represent it with the Greek letter that you're familiar with that looks like a little mini table. There's been a lot of debate about the Torah's knowledge of pi. In Sefer Melachim, in the 7th chapter, the 23rd Pasuk, in the Sefer Melachim, the Book of Kings, we're given the dimensions of the Yam Shel Shlomo, that basin that Shlomo HaMelech built for the Beis HaMikdash. We're told the Yam Shel Shlomo had a diameter of 10 amos and a circumference of 30 amos, seemingly calculating pi with the number 3 without all the decimal points. Similarly, the Mishnah in Erevin writes explicitly that the approximate value of the circumference of a circle is 3 if the diameter is 1. Did the Torah just approximate estimate the number, or, as many ask and wonder, was it wholly unaware of the irrational number called pi? Morris Engelson recently dealt with this, recently in Jewish history standards, dealt with this in an article that was published in Chakira called The Pool of Shlomo HaMelech and the Value of Pi. And he presents several solutions to this question of whether or not Chazal and the Torah actually knew about the calculation of pi itself. One ingenious solution attributed to the Vilna Gaon, but much more likely first suggested by Rabbi Matisyahu, Max Monk, wrote in the 1930s, points out that if you read the pasuk that describes the Yam Shel Shlomo, the word for circumference is written differently than it is pronounced, a distinction that is known as ksav and kri. Ksav is how the words are written, kri is how they are pronounced. And if you take the word for circumference in this pasuk, which is kaveh, that's how it's spelled, but it's pronounced kav without a hey, and you take the gematria of those two words, look it up in the pasuk. The gematria of the word kaveh, how it's spelled, is 111. Kuf, vav, hey. Kuf is 100, vav is 6, hey is 5. And the gematria of the pronunciation, kav, is 106, kuf and vav. If you take the ratio between 111 and divide it by 106, the ksav and the kri, and then multiply that by 3, the Torah's approximation of pi, calling it just 3, you actually get a value that is incredibly close to the true value of pi. 3 times 111 divided by 106 is 3.1415. It may be a hidden testament to the Torah's mathematical knowledge or a very improbable coincidence, but I find this suggestion incredibly brilliant. Irrational numbers and infinity challenge the concrete reality that many expected math to produce. When I was in high school, I read a book that I still think about today. Amir Achzel, I think I'm pronouncing that right, wrote a book called The Mystery of the Aleph, Mathematics, the Kabbalah, and the Search for Infinity. And it introduced me to a mysterious and misunderstood mathematician named Georg Cantor and his work Understanding the Nature of Infinity. Georg, which I obviously was incorrectly pronouncing as George for most of my life, it's Georg, suggested something radical. There is more than one kind of infinity. In fact, he suggested, some infinities are more infinite than others. To understand this, you have to imagine as follows. Imagine you have a line with numbers on it, like 1, 2, 3, a regular number line, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, stretching forever in both directions. This line represents what we call a countable infinity. It's like counting numbers. I could count all the numbers, 1 to 10. I could count all the odd numbers, all the even numbers. It's a countable infinity. No matter how high you count, there's always a number to count, but you are able to express each number. But Cantor thought about a different kind of infinity called an uncountable infinity. Imagine you have a line not with numbers, but with literally all the points on a line segment. Now try to count them. You might think that you can start at one end and just count each number to the other, but Cantor showed something really surprising. You can't. Even if you tried to count them forever, there'll always be more points left out. In between one and two, there are actually an infinite amount of numbers. In between any two whole numbers, Cantor pointed out, there are an infinite amount of numbers. And most of those numbers are wholly uncountable. Cantor called these uncountable infinities higher infinities. He developed a way to compare the sizes of different infinities, showing that some infinities are actually bigger than others. This was a revolutionary idea because before Cantor, people just thought of infinity as one big thing. Cantor's theory of infinity showed that there are different levels of infinity, some bigger than others, and it changed the way mathematicians think about the concept of infinity itself. But here's the amazing part. Cantor needed mathematical notation to symbolize the different orders of infinity. Most mathematics uses Greek notation, like pi that we just discussed, or sigma used to symbolize summation, or delta used to symbolize change. Cantor, quite shockingly, chose a different form of notation for infinity. He used the Hebrew letter Aleph. Now, many have speculated because of this about Cantor's Jewish identity, and his last name Cantor and the use of Hebrew notation certainly suggests some connection to Jewish thought and lineage. Still, most biographers have tried but struggled to find any real connection to Jewish lineage, although he was clearly a religious man. Cantor's ideas about infinity were controversial in his lifetime. His chief adversary, Leopold Kronecker, thought his ideas about higher orders of infinities drifted into the fantastic fantastical. God made the integers, Kronecker famously said. All else is the work of man. Interestingly, Rav Adin Steinsaltz, who we've spoken about previously, was once asked if the Torah makes mention of irrational or transcendental numbers. The difference between an irrational number can't be expressed, goes on forever as a fraction, but you can still have a square root of 2. A transcendental number can't even be expressed like a square root of 2. That's like pi or the golden ratio. And Rabbi Steinsaltz responded when he was asked, does the Torah know about irrational numbers? He actually quoted Kronecker, and he quoted in the German, "De ganze Zahlen hat er lieb gott gemacht, als anderes is Menschenwerk." That's my terrible German / Yiddish. God made the integers, all else is the work of man. The opposition to Cantor's ideas took a heavy toll on his mental health. He struggled with bouts of depression. He spent much of his later life manically trying to determine the true author of Shakespeare's work. There were periods he had to be institutionalized. History, however, looks favorably at the genius of Cantor. David Hilbert, one of the most renowned mathematicians of his time, convened a list of 23 problems that continued to vex mathematics and should be the primary focus of mathematical exploration in the 20th century. The first problem on his list was a deeper understanding of Cantor's work, the significance of which Hilbert continued to defend. Cantor ventured into infinity, saw a glimpse, and paid a very heavy personal price. To this day, Cantor's theory and his small aleph are still used in mathematic explorations into the concept of infinity. Which brings us back to our parsha and our aleph. In Rav Kasher's encyclopedic work, Torah Shlema, he cites a fascinating approach that explains the small aleph in the opening of our parsha. The Talmud says that there are 50 gates of divine understanding. There are Nun Sharei Bina, all of which were given to Moshe except one. One was out of reach. Our small aleph, this approach suggests, represents that 50th gate that was never fully given over to Moshe. As Valbrig Perry cites in her aforementioned article from the Sefer Bahir, the aleph in Kabbalistic literature, and as we know, doesn't make a sound because it contains, this is what the Sefer Bahir writes, it contains within it the root of all other letters. It's the infinite that contains all finite multitudes. So why include an aleph at all if the 50th gate was in fact not even given to Moshe? Like Cantor taught, there are orders of magnitude to the very notion of infinity itself. And while Moshe was not given full access to the complete expression of the infinite divine, he was still able to grasp some notion of the infinite when being called upon by God. And this is true for each of us as well. We may never be able to confront the infinite depth of a confrontation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with God, but each of us has an aspect of Moshe within us, and each of us, in our own way, is called upon by God. We each hear a Vayikra in our lives. And even within our very finite understanding and limited humanity, we are still able to glimpse a rendezvous with the infinite, our transcendent relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, I don't usually do this, but I want to add a Purim addendum. Purim is in 2 weeks, and I wanted to add something that relates to our discussion on the Megillah, a fascinating idea I heard many years ago from my Rebbe, Rev Ari Bergman, which he has in his incredible Sefer, Ari Bimistarim, that of course we link to, and I would recommend you reading. Megillah's Esther ends in a bizarre way, and stay with me, because I know you've had this question. The very conclusion of Esther discusses the tax policies of Achashverosh. Vayosem HaMelech Achashverosh Mas, a tax al ha'aretz v'iye hayam. And as we know, there's always one guy in Megillah who thinks it is hilarious to boo that part. God bless the chevra who boo at Mas. Good for him. But the ending is so strange. It always feels so anticlimactic. Why does the Megillah end with Achashverosh's tax policies? So as I mentioned, my Rebbe and mentor, really, Rav Ari Bergman, I've learned so much Torah from him over the years. I've written an article about my relationship with him and how he introduced me to Reb Tzadok in tradition that I think is worth reading. And he has an incredible approach in his Sefer Ari B'Mistarim. It's always difficult to find the area of a circle. We've been talking a lot about pi, and that's why pi is such an important number. It allows us to find precisely what the circumference of a circle is. A student of Plato, Eudoxus let me pronounce this correctly, Eudoxus. Eudoxus suggested that a circle should just be seen as a square with an infinite amount of sides. Take a square and then make it, instead of four sides, imagine it had now 10 sides, and now 30 sides, and now 50 sides, 100, 1,000 sides. The more sides you add, the closer it becomes to looking like an actual circle. In Kabbalistic literature as well, we have a similar division between Kav and Eagle, straight lines and circles, in the nature of the difference between circles and squares. Circles represent the infinite, as they are impossible to truly calculate without the irrational infinity of pi. Squares are finite. Just multiply the measure of each side, that whole integer, and you can easily find the area. And it is this representative distinction between circles and squares that can help explain the ending of the Megillah. The Hebrew word for taxation used at the end of the Megillah is mas. It is a two-word letter, a mem and then a samach. Look closely. The mem, and this is even more clear in the final mem, a mem sofit, represents a square, while the samach is clearly a circle. And this is really the punchline of the entire Megillah, turning our finite squares into infinite circles, taking the mem and transforming it into a samach. And this is what taxation is really all about. It's a reminder that not all of our work and efforts of our finite lives belong to us. Even if I'm the one who showed up at my job, part of my paycheck belongs to someone else. And this is the reminder of Purim itself, that even within our finite lives, even in a world without open miracles and prophetic revelation, even in a world absent the explicit name of God, we are still connected to the infinite divine. Our mem is still tethered to a samach. A part of our work in this world is still tethered, like taxation policy itself, still tethered to the divine. The square of our life is still attached to the circle. Our daily lives remain tethered to the infinite. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, especially this week, which I know is a doozy, especially if, like me, you got a little bit of that math anxiety. To get the links to all the articles and books mentioned, especially this week where we have so many diagrams that really help explain some of the concepts I presented, be sure to subscribe to our weekly email that you can access through Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. And thank you again to our sponsors and dearest friends, Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.